Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Janine, and you are listening to Lunch with Loudon. Coffee Talk Radio shows are part of the Coffee Party Be the Media Project. You can join our team at www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer. I can't say it enough. Be the media. So my favorite Be the Media volunteer, Debbie Lynn Molyneux, is joining me from Portlandia. But before I say hello to Debbie Lynn, I have a request of all of you on chat today. So listen up, chatters. I would appreciate comments from you in chat if our volume or clarity is out of whack at any time. I've been finding some audio challenges when I go back and listen to our show, and so I'm going to thank you in advance for giving us input on your listening quality. It's very important to us, but you have to remember we have a headset on and we hear ourselves, you know, and you. We don't get what you get on the podcast listening live, yeah. So, hey, Debbie Lynn.
Hey.
Say hello before we launch to our topic. It's about freedom, stupid.
I know. And we felt so little naughty because it's like, are we going to break the civility pledge? But we're not really calling anybody stupid. We're calling the whole system that we're, this whole game that we're in, stupid. Because this doesn't make sense. But I'm doing fine in Portland, by the way.
Everything's fine in Portland. It's a gray day in the Willamette Valley, so maybe the sun's come up where you are. And I do want to point out to people that Debbie Lynn and I had a major pre-show conversation about whether or not the title, which is intended to be a little whimsical and calling, sort of referencing, it's the job, stupid. So we decided that we trusted that you all had a sense of humor and that you join us in this joke, and that we weren't actually intending to offend or challenge anyone's beliefs with the term. So we hope the civility pledge is intact, and I hope you think so too. So I also want to remind people that we'd love to hear from you, our listeners, and you can dial 646-929-2495 and press 1 to be in the host queue. We sort of have a little timer on everyone, so we know how long you've been sitting there, and hopefully we take you in order. And also that if you're on chat now, if you actually log into Blog Talk Radio, you can join in the conversation there. And Debbie Lynn will bring some of your comments, if they're germane to what we're talking about in the moment. She'll bring them into the conversation live. So with that, let's begin. My inspiration for today's show was twofold. First, I was supposed to be at the Women's Health Day rally at the Oregon State Capitol, but my personal health is keeping me home, and that is uber ironic. But two, I am often challenged to connect the dots between the assault on women's freedoms, often tagged the war on women, and coffee party values. I personally have no trouble drawing the arrows connecting this trend, these series of assaults, if you will, to money in politics. To me, there's a very clear line, and this is symptomatic of what happens with that corrupt relationship that politicians have to their funders today. But Debbie Lynn, can you connect the dots? Do you see how this is connected?
Oh, I see how all of it is connected, because there's just such a system of corruption right now where all of these special interests, you know, whether it's women's issues or immigration or gay rights or what was the other one that I pointed out, they're all just tools that are being used to raise immense amounts of money and funnel our attention and shuffle our attention and energy from one issue to the next, while people are just, you know, raping and pillaging our political system and our economic system so that we don't actually catch on to what the bigger game is.
Right. I mean, we talk a lot on this show about the narrative. And the narrative is really like, what has fallen into common conversation? What do people say? What does that trigger? And how this narrative has been like focus panel tested, and it's actually very sophisticated. And it takes big bucks to do these things, to hone a message in such a way that the science of marketing is invoked and outcomes are predictable. And so we see that so much in what we call that war on women, or, you know, give me a better term. Someone in chat, give me the term you like to use, because I realize that actually the term war on women has become, is like branded, code word, invokes certain talking points, and that doesn't forward the action. So I have no intention here to imply to you that I know what's best for you, but I'm hoping that what we talk about today is how that influence, that economic, political influence on the way we talk about things in America affects how we solve problems in America, affects how we create problems in America. And so there's a genuine need here to depolarize this conversation and get down to what I consider the more essential question, which is, what is freedom? What does it mean? How is that concept of freedom being violated by this huge, right now in the state legislatures across America, there are dozens of bills that want to limit a woman's freedom to access medical science in many ways. And then there's the indirect ways of limiting that access, and that's by eliminating huge bundles of access, like access to healthcare at all, access to the money to access healthcare, access, you know, this is like a tumbleweed going across the prairie and sort of picking up, kicking up dust as it goes. You know what I'm saying? So freedom is the issue. I like to use the term rights, like what are your rights? But then we get into this weird conversation about the Constitution. And I promise you, that is a diversion. You know, who was it, Debbie Lynn? Was it Benjamin Franklin that basically was such a weird guy that he knew that if he was going to be free to be weird, then he had to allow other people freedom to be weird. You know, I mean, that's my paraphrase. But, you know, freedom is not, it's not a freedom to do as my faith would have you do. It's not freedom to impose anything other than to uphold a social or cultural standard. And so what I see slipping by these freedoms slipping is that there's a cultural standard, a social standard that is being eroded. You know, freedom's okay for some people and not for others. And that's when, you know, that will be the demise of this republic's democracy. That will be the demise of America as we know it, whether it's in access to health care, whether it's in the right to work at a job that actually supports you. So I'm looking to chat, and I'm looking to our callers that are in the queue that have not raised their hand to see if they want to weigh in, or Debbie Lynn and I are totally prepared to talk about this for the next 45 minutes, because believe me, we both experienced the travel, the trip from the first International Women's Day. You know, the first, I mean, there are a lot of positive firsts. You don't have to go right to Roe v. Wade. But Roe v. Wade was an acknowledgement of discriminatory practices. And so we've walked this road of correcting cultural discrimination, and now we see ourselves being pushed back, you know, pushed back into some myth, some mythology that how it used to be is better than now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's cruel and unusual punishment, actually. So, and you, Debbie Lynn.
Yeah, and I'm watching what's happening in chat here. And one of the things that one of our listeners, Lady Silent, is talking about common sense that is missing, and that one of the, and I'm just going to expand a little bit on what she's saying, and that we're so focused on breaking everyone into little groups that we're ignoring the our commonality, which is that we're all Americans. And a lot of that has been actually done by our marketing and by, we talk about the special interest groups. Well, everybody, we don't all have our own special interest groups. And part of it's been done by the way we've been cultured into our consumer roles so that we can, you know, so that people can sell us stuff, whether it's politics or gadgets or cars or homes or whatever. And it's, and we do that through, you know, by organizing demographics because they, you know, they know that, you know, certain groups of people are more likely to buy certain gadgets. And so we end up breaking it all out into these demographic groups and then psychographic groups. And then values groups. And so that then this is the sophistication that you were talking about, that it is so, so sophisticated that that it is, it's scary. It really is scary to me because it actually has become mind control on a massive scale. And this is my supposition, that people who are doing marketing today can... They build subdivisions now knowing exactly what value system the people who are going to be attracted to those homes. And so they build in, you know, the gated community or the little central park or what style of light poles are that they're going to put in based on what people's values are. And they know that from all the data they're gathering from us online of who all these people are. And
right, we are all very knowable.
Very knowable. And then it comes down to a political election, and if you have enough money to buy the information, such as our, you know, national politics, they do at the national level, you pretty much just have to figure out then, like, who are the people who are most likely to vote, what are their value systems, how do you get that message out there that's going to push their trigger points to make them respond. And voila, you know, get people to the polls, and that's how you know to win. And it's also how they district things, how the redistricting comes into play. This is how they choose how to redistrict so that they have safe seats. It's very sophisticated, and it was all started, if in case anybody doesn't know this, by Sigmund Freud's nephew back in the 1920s, almost 100 years into this style of marketing. And I say
Right. Well, it's from what you said and from my experiences, Debbie Lynn, divide and conquer is alive and well in politics today. I believe that there are two things that marketing energy does. One is divide us into itty-bitty groups, pretending we, as you said, have no commonality.
Right.
And, which is why, for one reason, I think that this war on women is like murder by 1,000 paper cuts, you know, because... whether it's minimum wage, which affects women more, whether it's the glass ceiling, which is obviously a women's issue, whether it's the social safety net, which actually affects women heads of household more, or if it's corporate welfare, women working for companies that couldn't make it if they actually paid a living wage to their employees and rely on emergency rooms and food stamps and housing allowances so that those women can work for them, you know, can afford to work for them. I mean, this is... so the whole notion that we are the invisible majority and that all of the assaults on the American worker are assault on American women workers, that all assaults on voting rights are assaults on American women's voting rights, and that we, in most statistics, not all, I don't want to get out my little violin here, but seriously, because we are the invisible majority, these things actually affect us more. But let me tell you what doesn't affect us more. All that prosperity and wealth at the top, you know, is not proportionate in any way. I mean, I read a piece the other day, and maybe, Debbie Lynn, you remember where this came from because you and I discussed it. But it said, you know, historically, there's absolutely no reason for women to not be equally represented in politics or women not being equally represented in the boardrooms because for over 30 years, women have had parity in education. As a matter of fact, today, more women attend college, more women graduate with honors, more women enter the workplace over-prepared for the work they can find. You know, so this still is not a matter of, well, when you girls catch up with us, then, you know, you'll get a key to the clubhouse restroom or whatever the heck. You know, you get to wear the green jacket, so to speak, for all you golfers out there. So there is not as much of this marketing hides the truth from us as well as it asserts a reality upon us.
And I just want to, you know, we've got some great conversation going on in the chat room. I just want to give a big shout out to that. And I want to say that, you know, I don't want to make, I mean, women is our special interest, Janine, for you and me. That is used to divide us, and then when men hear us talk, they think that we're not for men. And that is separating us then from our men. And I love men. I don't think that there's any separation here. And so I, you know, I'm really cautious about that and in how we frame it, because it's one of the, it is, while all these facts that you're talking about, you know, with the way the cuts are happening are going to impact women disproportionately more so than men, it is still going to impact men. It's going to impact little boys that are the sons of these women. And as they grow up, they're going to have a different outlook on life because of that. It's
right,
not
right.
That.
If you ditch public school, you know, who relies on public school more than anybody, you know? Yes, it affects our children. But, you know, as we learned from that video you sent to me, Debbie Lynn, it was called Wealth and Inequality in America, and it has been circulated widely by Upworthy. But in that video, you learn the statistics. It's very graphic. It's very number-oriented. But it becomes very clear that we all, the 99%, are far worse off than we perceive ourselves to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so it follows suit that women as a group are way more worse off than even we perceive, because all of these things where the society, economy are failing us, fail women as strongly or more strongly than they fail men. Now, does that mean exactly what you said? Is this a woman versus man issue? Absolutely not. And it is lean, mean marketing machine that will have you polarize this concept. What we're trying to point to is that it's even more basic than the whole listing of all votes. Things that work well for everybody. But it's also true that it creates women as a liability in the units of society, whether it's the family, whether it's the workplace, by oppressing this group. This invisible majority, you oppress us all. It costs us all, except the few for whom it is profitable. The few, the 1% that financially, socially, whatever way you want to end in L-Y to, benefit. And as we know, this is not a conversation anymore. That is the 1% or less than 1% of people. So women are like being created as an anchor to the potential prosperity and wealth of all Americans. And it's like, serious. I mean, when you spend more in childcare than you make at your job, something's wrong. Something is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I
want to push back on that a little bit when you're done.
Oh, no, go ahead. And then after you do, we'll go to our first caller.
Yes, that would be great, because I think it's Jack.
Oh, goodness.
The COO from Facebook just put out a book recently, and she pointed to two things. I'm going to put a link in the chat room to an article about it. Sheryl Sandberg is her name. And she published this book that was just released this week called Lean In, and she talks exactly about what you're referencing, Janine, about how our system itself hasn't welcomed women in top executive places. And she is pointing to how women who are in the executive leadership roles need to stand up and fight for the injustice of you know, basically our society not taking better care of women. Because it is, you know, like she coined an example of when she was pregnant and she was late for a meeting and she had to park way out in the boondocks and walk in, and she just went into her boss and the next day and said, we need to have, you know, close-in pregnancy spaces because we're not handicapped, but, you know, we shouldn't have to be toting stuff all this way because we're, you know, blah, blah. So, you know, so short-term, like, let's just take better care. But she also then goes on to talk about what women need to do internally to lean in and step up and take and own their own power. So she, her epiphany was that, oh, wow, look at me. Nobody ever brought this up to anybody's attention before to say, hey, this is something that needs to happen. And so as a woman, it's my obligation to lean into this and to exercise the power I do have in my life and to point out when things are not fair and to step in and lean in and do my part. And to stop apologizing for being a woman of power, because there is, you know, when a man gets more successful through his career, he's looked up to more. And if a woman gets more successful in her career, she gets more isolated. These are just facts of what we do in our culture.
Yes.
And
yes.
And so those, so culturally, those things need to change. And women still, we still need as women to do it anyway.
Right, right. I mean, doesn't every revolution begin at home? I mean, mm-hmm. You know, the culture that we live and express in our own lives every day is always the seed of the solution. It begins here. It begins
right
here. But I just saw in chat, and Jack, we're about to come to you. I just saw in chat a comment about women voting. I'm going to translate to women voting against their own self-interest, you know. And I'm going to say two things about that. They're very quick. One, I think women voting against their own self-interest is because they don't know, you know, it's like the success of the robber baron sales and marketing plan. That's what I call it. The robber baron sales and marketing plan is so successful that many women vote against their own self-interest, just like many men do. You know, but again, the second thing I want to say is, who votes? Who gets to vote? We know that voter suppression efforts are on the rise. Gifts from ALEC, I might add. All this model legislation in the states came right out of the ALEC playbook. And it's important, therefore, I have to conclude that it's important for the status quo, it's important for the trending that's going on in America now, that certain people not vote. Well, certain people includes us, Debbie Lynn. It includes us.
Yes.
And many, we know from our earlier conversations on earlier shows with women who are in the trenches with this, how many women are knocked out of the voting rolls if they haven't changed their identification from their maiden name to their married name. How many women mm-hmm. are thrown out of the voter rolls if they're in temporary housing? How many, you know, I could go on and on. Are these things true for men? Well, the name change might not be, but everything else is true. I don't want to say this is exclusionary, but man, it affects us. It affects mm-hmm. us hugely. And so, listen, with that, I don't want to make our caller wait any longer. We'll come back to this, I'm sure, Debbie Lynn. Area code 620, your mic is live. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
This is Jack Golding. You hear me?
I knew it. Hey, Jack, I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, my friend. Okay. We're just talking about, seems to me we're talking about Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook.
Yes.
Is that what I'm gathering?
I was talking about her, Jack. Yeah, this is Debbie Lynn.
Okay. I just try to get, wrote an email to her just to say, great, she's considering looking at men too, as far as trying to get everybody to be successful. And and I said, "What me at? Try to think of me. Consider me at 81. Trying to be, because I still think I have a life ahead of me."
Yes, you do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the other thing I'm thinking of, maybe it's a little off the course, but we've had rapes in the Army, in the military, above women. They're complaining about that.
Oh.
And men have had that too, because I've been watching the news lately, and it's been very disturbing. To see that generals, let me be off the subject. A general can overrule. A general don't know nothing about the law or psychology or anything like that, can overrule
a ruling?
Decision of a military court.
I had no idea that that was true.
Yeah, that's happened. That's happened. I've been watching the news today. And this is something that, the new Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Hagel, has
right,
to
defense.
Investigate and make the final decision as to what the heck to do about all those rapes in the military.
Absolutely. I think the fact that anyone tolerates
I think it's a power thing. Yeah, that's what it is. It's not the desire for sex. It's a desire to express power, and power is a problem when you deal with Congress or dealing a problem. Money is power.
Right, right. Well, and there are many forms of power, and I think that there's a lot of evidence that we as human beings try to first preserve our own power and then sometimes feel the need to exert that influence over others. And it's kind of a thing that mammals do, you know. But supposedly the thing that's different about us and, you know, your pet collie is that we can transcend any notion and adopt instead a philosophical choice. We can invent a future that does not exist, which is unique to, you know, greater primates, as far as I know, as far as can be documented. And so what we're really asking here is that we all consider the possibility of creating or resisting this notion that we cannot transcend whatever these conversations are, that we cannot generate a future that works for everyone, with no one left out. And so we keep dividing ourselves up into little groups and saying, okay, well, this group doesn't matter so much, so they can lose out here. This group doesn't matter so much, so... I mean, it's nonsense, but go ahead, Jack. I interrupted you.
I think I said what I need to say. I think this Sheryl Sandberg offers a hope to transcend everything beyond our limitations.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well said, Jack. As always, thank you for calling in.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
I think that's about a year.
So, this is, I think that Jack makes some important points, which is that the belief that things can work for women is a belief that things can work for everyone. And, yeah, I'm looking at it from from this set of shoes. You know, my moccasins might look a little different from your moccasins, but we're all going, hopefully, the 99% anyway, is walking the same path or wants to, is trying to walk that same path. And Debbie Lynn, you know, in your comments on the blog, you noticed or you expressed an interest that when things get tough, it's the usual suspects that get blamed and vilified. And I wondered if you wanted to say a little bit about that.
Well, this is just more, I guess over the last 10 years or so, I've just noticed when people feel insecure, you know, and I'm talking about all of us, you know, the whole country, when economic times are tight and jobs are scarce and stuff, there's a tendency to want to say, okay, whose fault is it? And this happened 100 years ago, you know, right in the height of the Great Depression, too, that we look to, like, whose fault is it? Who, you know, who can we blame? Because it's not my fault. And so, you know, and I talk about the usual suspects get blamed, and it's, you know, first the immigrants, and then it's anybody who's, you know, different or not mainstream, if you will. And so it's immigrants, it's women, it is gay, you know, people who are gay. It's like, it's all the, and that's what I call the usual suspects. So,
which has been expanded to include poor.
Minorities, yeah.
Right. If you're poor. Mm-hmm. That's a new one, too. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, well, I was just trying to think. Minorities was the other group. So it's more creating this us versus them. It gets back to this tribal mentality of, like, you know, when we were talking before the show, it's like Hatfield and McCoy. So this gets this us versus them, and it just adds to this divide and conquer type mentality. So it's kind of like, okay, well, let's keep everybody busy over there, because even though it's an economic downturn, let's make sure we make money on it, you know, if we're in the 1% or the banking industry or whatever. And because there's a way that we can, you know, if we get them to vilify each other, they won't pay attention to what's behind the curtains.
No, precisely, precisely. So I see that you have inspired a caller, Debbie Lynn. So I'm opening up...
It's Dan.
I'm opening up 503. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
It's Dan.
Don't sound like Dan.
Well, Debbie Lynn said it that way, so I figured that was the appropriate response.
I'm going to say it's Dan.
Yeah, so she's probably tired of watching me lob some grenades into the chats, and I just wanted to come on and have a little bit more of a discussion about it. So I was a person who started posting stuff about the women's voting records.
Cool. I didn't recognize that.
It has me on as a host, so I didn't mean to. But
okay.
Yeah, so I mean, for those who aren't in the chats or weren't paying attention, I mean, at least all I was able to do is pull up really quick stuff on the presidential elections, but women have voted 43% to 50% for Republicans since 1980, every election since 1980, and for the past 12 elections, women have actually outnumbered men in overall voting. So there seems to be a big disconnect within the female community. And the thing that Debbie Lynn said that actually made me hit the one was when she talked about Hatfields and McCoys.
Yes.
And I will, as a man, which I will claim to be, one of the things that gets a little tiresome is that this is men are persecuting women, and that's why all this is happening. But then when you look at the voting record of women, that they're not helping.
Well, I hope you saw in my response both in chat and on the air now that I don't think that at all. I think it's not men versus women. I think that's what the narrative wants you to perceive. And, of course, since that's ridiculous, then we look silly, you know, if you're sort of enrolled in this this conversation, what it is. And I will say it again, and this is why this is a coffee party issue as far as I'm concerned, is that there is big financial interest in subjugating the American worker, the American citizen, the American voter, and there is big bucks behind it, ALEC is brilliant proof of that. The Americans United for Life is big proof of that. Chamber of Commerce is big proof of that. NRA is big proof of that. You and I can just go back and forth for the next minute naming off organizations that are engaged in funneling money to focused causes for the benefit of a few and the detriment of the many. And so to me, if we can see this, what I call the death by a thousand paper cuts against women, as evidence of that strategy, if you want to call it that strategy, then we can then the clouds start to clear. It becomes more clear. Well, who's doing this? Why are they doing it? Why are they imposing faith on us, their faith on us? Because I promise you, I'm not a person without faith, but I am a person whose faith does not cause me to join many of these organizations that are telling us what to do, limiting our freedoms, limiting our access to medical science, right? And so the notion has been successful that this is men versus women, and it is not. It is not. It is the 1% versus the 99%. It is the havers versus the have-nots. It's like, you know, so when you say the Hatfields and McCoys, you're talking, the only thing that makes that a bad, what that's more indicative of is the false feuding that happens between you and me, for example, or you and, you know, me and my brother. We just get polarized. And the polarization is an indication of success of the marketing strategy, because polarization is one of the goals of the marketing strategy. So does that make sense?
Sure. So as you know darn well, I agree with every single thing you just said. And yes, and the way that they describe it in the transpartisan, the book on transpartisanship is that the perception that they want us to believe is that if you graph us out and plot out every person and their viewpoints on the single axis bar, you end up looking like something that looks like a dumbbell, where
yes,
it's split 50-50, but we're all out at the ends. When the truth of the matter is, it looks much more like a football, where, yes, we have varied left and right, but we are all in total much closer to the center. And that is exactly what they want us to do. They want us to believe that the other person is – that we're just fighting the extremes. So, again, agreed with everything you say. And just like as I always say when I talk about the economic factors is, why are people who are poor – voting for people who want to put in austerity measures and want to never increase taxes on the rich and want to continue subsidies that funnel money from the poor? Why do people vote against their self-interest? And that's exactly what you said in the beginning when you answered me on the chats. So how do we change? How do we get them to knock them upside the head and go, snap out of it, see what is real, and act on it?
Well, my answer is the standard coffee party answer, and I am steeped in this to my very bones, which is this: politicians have to dance for dollars. Half of these people, they know something won't pass, but they vote for it anyway, because by doing that little dance step, they get more money from ALEC, or they get more money from this group, or they get more money from that group. Certain donors focus on people who do what they want. And so they're all in this inherently corrupt system. They are not inherently corrupt people, most of them. I would assert a few might be. But the system is poisoned by this need to, the day you're elected, start either paying off your past campaign or financing your future campaign. And so, of course, they pay attention to the big role, the high rollers. They have to in this environment. So publicly funded campaigns freeze the elected. It liberates the elected from the influence of financiers to the influence of voters. And I think once they are not the drones, if you will, the drones of destruction for the process, then we have an obligation to use the value of the vote to turn the course of the ship of state. In other words, it may be true that poor people are voting against their self-interest, some poor people are doing that. But it's also true that huge numbers of poor people are not voting. And that is by design. We are making it more and more and more difficult for people who are going to have to choose, am I going to have food for the last week of the month, or am I going to go buy the birth certificate that will allow me to get the state voting ID, whatever that may be. Seriously, I've talked to these people time and time again on my show. And so it's important, I think, to see that this is a complicated strategy. It's a highly effective strategy. And when people stop voting against their self-interest, we'll see that we're turning the tide on that strategy. Did I say too much, Dan?
No, never. Are you kidding me? It's the beauty of the show. So,
yeah.
As always, lovely ladies, lovely show. As always, lovely. I'm going to speak now. No, it's a great show. It's interesting, always interesting, as far as I'm concerned, to draw parallels between, as exactly you're doing, between different groups and how they're targeted. And you're right. I mean, it's just that we're all wandering around in this fog, and it's like we don't even see the person right next to us. And I don't know, we just somehow we've got to bring the big fan and blow away the fog, and so everybody can see what's really going on. Because if we can't do that, then it's, whether you're poor, whether you're a minority, whether you're an immigrant, whether you're a woman, it doesn't matter. We're never going to get anywhere until people wake up. So.
Right. And before I go to the next caller, I just want to point to something. I don't know how many of you are lifeguards, if you've ever been trained to be a lifeguard. But one of the hardest lessons for a lifeguard to get their wrap their head around is sometimes the person you're trying to rescue you will drown you. And it's, I think sometimes we become so desperate that we don't recognize the guy who's trying to save us. You know what I'm saying? And so that, I think that, that drowning your lifeguard is a lot like voting against your self-interest. You have to actually be in a state of mind where you can recognize what will work, what a winning strategy for you personally might be, as opposed to this gut instinct to just grab and dunk anything that's near you. So it's really frightening. Hey, hang on, Dan. I'm going to go to the next caller, but if you're still there, I might come back to you. Would that be okay?
I will. You bet.
Thanks so much.
And I just want to pull one thing in from the chat room before we go to Laura.
Okay.
And that's that in addition to publicly financed campaigns, having federal voting rules so that it's the same everywhere is another possible solution.
Hallelujah. You know, I mean, this is why ALEC has gone to the states. They have their whole state legislative program. It's because they're hot to have confusion. They're hot to have prohibitive rules. They ride a lot on these kind of bumper sticker logic ideas, like, you know, why wouldn't you have ID? Everybody has ID. And it's like, actually not. So the truth is inconsequential in these movements. But when the elected dance for dollars, when they jump through the hoop, when the dog trainer says jump through the hoop, they get their little biscuit, which is their campaign contribution. So too often they'll buy into the bumper sticker logic because they know at the end of that buy-in is big money, is campaign contributions. And so I'm sorry, but this is just a corrupt system. It's undignified. There's no dignity in this for the elected, especially the elected that see the problem and can't interrupt it themselves. They really need us to support them in changing this.
Right.
Go ahead.
And that's from Ray. I just want to give a shout out to Ray who came up with that idea. We have Laura Holden for us on the line.
True enough. And frankly, you know, I think the feds can make rules about federal elections. So they can make rules about the presidential election. And in so doing, they can create huge precedent about what states can and cannot do. Like I think you can all sort of take that to the logical conclusion. I don't want to hold up Laura any longer. So, area code 513, your mic is open. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
Hello, Loudon. I made notes so I wouldn't forget this time.
You're a genius.
First of all, we got to get away from 1%. Do you know what 1% means?
It's the really rich cream at the top of the milk. What?
Oh, no. It only means $400,000 a year. And do you know how little that is in some places?
Well, I'm happy to say the 0.5% or the 0.1% because that's actually the more accurate. But
Think 0.4% is actually the more accurate. The 0.4% is the old, you know, Sisters of the American Revolution, descendants of the Mayflower, Money Forever crowd.
In defense of those patriots, I'll have you know that my husband's family came over on the Mayflower, and one of his family signed the Declaration of Independence. And I promise you, this is a family that is strongly rooted in progressive values. So, you know, I just don't want to diss the daughters of the American Revolution that still believe that women are equal.
Oh, okay. So not all of them are like, we have our own little in crowd, kind of like
right.
In high school. You know, we're the little rich cheerleader crowd.
Okay, now I'm going to stand up for cheerleaders here. Careful, Laura. You're talking to a high school cheerleader and a college cheerleader. But you know what? For me, it was a sport. And I think for a lot of us, it is. And I will grant you that some people's experience of cheerleaders is less than intellectual. But anyway, the GPA of my college cheerleading team, the women, was 3.8.
Oh, not talking about on an intellectual level. I'm talking about on a snobbery, I'm higher on the scale than everyone else level.
Oh, well, that wouldn't have been
better
me.
Better than
but,
you level.
But I get the
I'm prettier
the story
than you. I'm more popular than you. I'm better than you level.
Oh,
my
yeah.
social That's... scale is up here. Yours is down there. You're not as good as me because you're not a cheerleader.
Right, right. Well, and you know, that is actually where the term entitled came from. The entitled were people with titles. You know, Lord of the Manor, Sir whomever, you know, the Duke of whatever. They were the entitled. And
uh-huh.
So entitled became synonymous with landowners and wealth, inherited wealth. And so I assert that holds true today, that 0.4% you're talking about are actually the entitled.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
They're entitled to keep what they got.
Or so they think.
Yeah. Oh, and the other thing is I have always heard that women are worse on women than men are on women. That if you go up on a rape trial, you better hope there's more men on your jury than there are women, because
seriously,
the women will rip you apart and call you whore faster than any man will.
Well, you know, don't you think that's a part of the rape culture that we're discussing in women's literature today? The whole rape culture says the victim asked for it, the victim was inappropriate, the victim should have had a gun, the victim should have, as opposed
yeah,
to,
well,
guess
the main
what,
thing
there's
here,
crime going on.
The victim shouldn't have been there. The victim shouldn't have been dressed like that. The victim shouldn't have been out alone. The victim shouldn't have been out that late at night, blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Exactly. And what a double standard. What a double standard.
But it's women who usually say that the most, not the men.
Maybe that's true. Maybe that's true. And if that's true,
yeah.
I don't know that that's true or not, but if it is true, then we need to design our conversation. You know, the 99% media, or apparently the 99.5% media, needs to shift the narrative in such a way that women embrace one another, or at least give each other the benefit of the doubt, or at least are willing to examine that ever-present notion, that little voice in their head that says, well, she should have known. Right?
Well, you know what? They don't want to. That lets fear in. That lets fear in, and they don't want to let fear in. See, I can keep the door closed on fear if I said it's her fault. Because as long as it's her fault, then I don't have to admit that it can happen to me when it's not my fault. I just
yes.
then don't have to say, well, I can't go out at night. I can't be blameless and have it happen to me.
Yes.
Does that make
yes,
sense?
Yes, no. Oh, I do. I do. I know that there's this notion that blame is a form of denial.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get to 34 years ago yesterday, my little six-week-old boy died. And I had this ridiculous experience. I mean, among all that grief and among all that upset, the thing that I could not get is how people wanted to somehow blame us. Because and it became clear to me later, it was because if I'd done something wrong, then they weren't at risk. If I had done something wrong, then their baby wouldn't die.
Yep,
and it was
exactly.
it was a huge lesson in kind of that human denial mechanism. And so I didn't feel that, once I figured it out, I didn't feel the need to fight it unless it was mean-spirited. Some people are mean-spirited. But in general, I just got it that it's too
terrible.
You know,
why do their brains go right to, oh, my God, that could happen to me? Why can't their brains go? See, my brain doesn't go there. I don't understand. My brain goes right to your heart. My brain goes, oh, my God, that would hurt so bad if that happened to me.
Right, right, and it's the fear. But let's bring this to politics. Let's take the same kind of tragedy. I mean, I had my personal tragedy, but what about the people foreclosed on? And now, when it's really too late to do anything about it, we find out there was illegal mischief in the foreclosures. You know, now, and what about the people who are prevented from voting? That is also a tragedy. What about the people who are, I mean, the screaming about minimum wage possibly going up to what it is now in Oregon, by the way. Oregon is one of the highest minimum wages in the country. But
I got news for you. Every year since I had my first job, I've heard somebody screaming about minimum wage going up. I don't care if it hadn't gone up in 10 years. Somebody would scream the next time it would go up.
Right, right, right. And, you know, I've had many employees during my tenure as a business owner, and never more than 40 at a time, but I've had a lot of employees. And you know what? I've never once in my life had a minimum wage employee. Never. Because you can't live on it. And if you can't live on it, then how can you expect someone to stay on the job long enough to be good at it? You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like treating us all like children. You know, some people like to use the term, you know, the nanny state. You know, they say that government has become overly parental. And I assert that it is not the people in need of the social safety net that have caused this need to be parental. It is the people who treat the American worker, the American citizen, the American voter like a child. You know, like only a teenager saving money for a new car or saving money for college who lives on someone else's expense, lives with their parents, can exist on minimum wage. And yet American quote-unquote business says, you know, the government is being parental by insisting that we actually pay them something they can live on. You know, it's a crazy language. It's a languaging from the truth to falsehood, a languaging from on the money to blurry.
What our claim is that only high school kids and kids in college take those kinds of jobs.
Right.
Well, let's examine something
like. And I got a bridge. I got a bridge in New York to sell you.
Yeah, let's look at people who work for Kroger. How many years ago was it when you got a job at Kroger, you had it made? You were part of a union, were paid well. Now you get a raise only when minimum wage goes up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's in the 1980s, if you wanted a handyman in the neighborhood, you paid him $10 an hour, right? You know, someone to rake leaves or clean your gutters. And every neighborhood had a handyman, or at least where I grew up, they did. And now, it's how many years later? 80, 90, it's 25 years later. And a handyman today is $10 an hour. The same. The same as it was in 1980. So, yeah, this is nutsy. But, go ahead.
Oh, and whoever it was it you, Debbie Lynn? Yeah, let's not forget that even if we publicly fund campaigns, as long as money is freedom of speech, people can still buy commercials.
I know.
That's why when Dan was talking about this subject, I said, well, you really need to talk to the crooks to write the laws because they're going to see the weaknesses there. Honest people will never see them.
Well, and this is where, you know, we can tie back in. Dan's show on Monday was talking about dark money and all these so-called nonprofits that are spending, have these secret donors, and then they spend money, you know, on political advertising and gain access. You know, and Obama's doing it right now. There's two big, you know, Dan highlighted it on Monday on his show, and it's in the New York Times and Mother Jones today about how people who are big donors to Organizing for Action, who's not disclosing who their donors are, but they're getting to meet with Obama. you know, hello. You know, we're worried about Alec and the Koch brothers, and yet it's happening on everywhere. So,
well, and it's an indicator that this is a corrupt system.
It's a system. It's a system, exactly.
And so, Laura, we're heading to the end of our show. Any last words of wisdom for us before I move on?
Nope, you guys, there's plenty of wisdom, but I'm tapped out for now.
Thanks for calling, Laura.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
And I just want to tie back in one thing that Laura brought up. You know, we were talking about, you know, and you, Janine, hit on it perfectly, too, about the form of denial that we want to blame other people because we don't want things like that happening to us.
Yes.
And that might just be why people vote against their own self-interest.
I believe so. I believe that plays a part. It's a strong piece of human nature to deny atrocities. I mean, that's why those safety films that show everybody hacked up and disemboweled and dismembered, they don't work. You
right.
need to empower people to behave safely on the job or in a car, not scare them into it. I'm not a believer of that. So we're about 3 minutes and counting, and so I want to take just a moment to tell everybody that Lunch with Loudon, as brilliant as it may be, is not the only radio show on Coffee Talk Radio. Mondays at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern, Dan Aronson hosts Press One for Democracy. And thanks, Dan, for your great call today. Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, conservative Michael Charney and progressive Eric Beiler host The Middle Ground. Thursdays, Lunch with Loudon, as you know. Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, Alberto Willis, Politics Done Right. All a part of the Coffee Party USA Be the Media project. Coffee Party USA is a grassroots organization, like no kidding, funded totally by our members. Citizens United has not benefited us, I promise. If you like the show or anything that you see Coffee Party doing these days, become a member. You do that by going to www.coffeepartyusa.com. You can go /member or /join if you don't want to go through the clicking. If you want to go through the clicking, go to coffeepartyusa.com, hit join the movement, hit become a member, and then go for it. You can join me as a sustaining member where I give a little bit every month to keep the Coffee Party fires burning, or you can do a one-time per year membership. Membership is everything to us, and I appreciate every one of you. So, Debbie Lynn, we're about to go. Last words?
Yeah, just if you get to coffeepartyusa.com, there's a big red button on the right-hand side. You can just click that.
Oh, well, that's right. We have cool technology with great graphics.
We're working on it. Yeah, but I just want to say thank you to everybody who participated today. We had a great chat room going on, had lots of good thoughts, and it's awesome to have our Coffee Party community come around and to let us play a little bit with our language and the subject line and not go off on us, because we were a little bit concerned.
Well, absolutely, and, you know, as always, you know, altering the narrative, use of language, offers people an opportunity to see something newly. And with that, I'm going to thank everyone and say Coffee Party on.